This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Barsmith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Now, I hope we're beginning bang on time. According to my watch, we are. Can I do the usual reminder, please, and remind everybody to turn off their mobile phones and pagers if you haven't already done so, or to switch them on to silent? I'm Margaret Anderson from the History Trust of South Australia, and it's a great pleasure today to welcome Professor Ian McCalman to Adelaide and to what I think is his first attendance at the Adelaide Festival of Ideas. Now, you'll know his biography from the book, but if I can briefly summarise, having been given stern instructions from one of our participants this afternoon. Ian is a professorial fellow and the ARC Federation Fellow at the University of Sydney. He's a cultural historian with a broad interest in 18th and 19th century European history and a more particular interest in popular culture, in intellectual history, and not entirely by contrast, I think he would argue, what he describes succinctly as lowlife. Not that there's any intention to suggest that Darwin was lowlife. He also has an active interest in the uses of history in the different media, and he's participated in a number of projects in that light, in film, exhibitions in museums and other multimedia. He's worked with the BBC, the ABC and the History Channel, and with a range of museums in Australia and overseas. One of those projects was a reenactment series of Cook's first voyages. But it's his most recent book that we are going to hear about today, and this is his contribution here. It's in the bookshop. I urge you to have a look for it. His contribution to the plethora of publications which have come out in this year because of the rather extraordinary coincidence of the bicentenary of Darwin's birth and the sesquicentenary of The Origin of Species. It's a group biography that has been widely praised for the fresh perspective it brings to the Darwin story, which is something of a feat, I think you'll agree, and the insights it offers into the evolution of those theories developed by Darwin, he argues, in association and collaboration with a group of others. Ian's topic this afternoon is Darwin's Armada, pushing the intellectual boundaries from academe to trade book and TV series. Will you welcome Ian, please?
Thank you very much, Margaret, and thank you very much, friends from Adelaide, coming out on a windy Sunday afternoon to hear me. I'm very privileged. Pardon me if I do have a bit of a frog in my throat. I only arrived from the UK last night and picked up something on the plane. Not swine flu. Charles Darwin's funeral took place at Westminster Abbey on Wednesday, the 26th of April, 1882. 20 years earlier, the press had taunted him as the devil's disciple, the scientist whose theory of evolution had eliminated the divine creator and turned man into the cousin of a monkey. Now, the Pall Mall Gazette spoke for all in calling him the greatest Englishman since Newton. His more than 2,000 mourners at the Abbey made up a who's who of the Victorian establishment. So many had applied for admission cards that the undertakers were hard-pressed to complete the preparations. The body had arrived at 8 o'clock the evening before after a long, slow, horse-drawn passage from the village of Down to Westminster, accompanied for the entire 16 miles by an icy drizzle. The coffin was carried into the dim lamplight of the Abbey's chapel of St. Faith to perch like a small wooden ship in dry dock, awaiting its last voyage. As the bell tolled noon, the Queen's chaplain in ordinary, Canon George Protheroe, opened the ceremony with the song, "I Am the Resurrection," glossing over Darwin's well-known scepticism about life after death. Darwin did not hold with the idea of a divine designer. He believed only in nature's implacable laws of chance, struggle, change, survival, or extinction. Man was one fortunate product of that ceaseless historical process. 10 pallbearers bobbed the coffin slowly up the nave to its resting place beside the statue of Sir Isaac Newton. Among the dignitaries, 3 ordinary-looking middle-aged men gripped the handles. Thomas Henry Huxley, biologist, aged 57, was tall and thick-set with a beak-like nose and heavy side whiskers. Next to him walked botanist Joseph Dalton Hooker, aged 65, spectacled, stooped and slight, with a fine ruff of hair looking rather like a lion past his cadaverous face. Striding at the rear came zoo geographer Alfred Russel Wallace, aged 59, thin, tall and wiry, with glinting spectacles and a heavy white beard. Then the coffin sank from sight, and Charles Darwin set out on his last voyage to meet the earthworms he'd been so recently studying. He expected no immortality, but the commemoration this year of the bicentenary of his birth has resounded all over the world. How is it, though, that these 3 particular naturalists, Huxley, Hooker, and Wallace, came to be carrying Darwin's coffin? In essence, they were his most intimate friends, his closest intellectual collaborators, and his fiercest advocates. All 3 recognised that this funeral was perhaps the last and greatest symbolic battle in a war they'd been fighting for 20 years. It had been a fierce, unremitting public campaign in defence of Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection, against a host of scientists, philosophers, clergymen, politicians and others who found its irreligious implications unacceptable. By extension, too, theirs was a fight for the kind of non-theological, fact-gathering and law-making mode of science that Darwin represented. Huxley, known as Darwin's bulldog, was a biologist, paleontologist and social philosopher, among many other things. He'd been tireless in taking Darwin's ideas out to the public and in extending the implications of evolution to other spheres of science, culture, and social thought. Hooker, botanist and biogeographer, was the man whom Darwin called my public and my judge, and whom he depended on for crucial knowledge of Australia and the Southern Hemisphere. Wallace, zoogeographer and naturalist, was Darwin's true knight, who in 1858 had arrived independently at the theory of natural selection while on the island of Gilolo in the Malay Peninsula. It was his discovery that goaded Darwin into writing and publishing The Origin of Species. Because Darwin had not then made his ideas public, the generous young naturalist Wallace accorded all priority and fame to the older man. Wallace thought of himself as merely a guerrilla chief of the evolution war, while Darwin, he said, is the great general who can manoeuvre the largest army and lead on his formation to victory. Though Wallace used a military metaphor, a maritime one would have been equally apt. What had brought these 4 very different figures together in the first place was their separate participation as young men in daring scientific voyages of exploration to the Pacific, Indian and Antarctic seas, and to the southern lands of Australia, New Zealand, New Guinea, Southeast Asia and Antarctica. Darwin, Hooker and Huxley had served their informal scientific apprenticeships on British naval survey ships, respectively the Beagle from 1831 to 6, the Erebus from 39 to 43, and the Rattlesnake from 46 to 50. Darwin travelled in a private capacity as the captain's naturalist companion, while Hooker and Huxley were lowly assistant surgeons, surgeon's mates. Wallace, the poorest of all, voyaged as a zoological collector in native prows and canoes up and down the Amazon, from 1848 to 52, and then around the Malay archipelago for more than 14,000 sea miles between 1854 and 62. All four experienced their southern journeys as transformative, of their careers, their scientific ideas, their personal lives, and their characters. In Darwin's case, we tend to overemphasize the importance of the Galapagos component of his Beagle voyage at the expense of what went after. His less heralded voyaging among the island laboratories and continents of the Pacific and Indian Oceans produced a luminous and often underestimated phase of theorizing. This would help to shake him from his orthodox belief that species were the fixed products of multiple divine creations, and it would contribute to new understandings of human societies and ecologies. During the 1850s, while living the life of an ailing hermit at Down House, 16 miles from London, Darwin consciously recruited Hooker, Huxley, and Wallace as friends and collaborators. Without them, it is doubtful whether he would have published his theory in his own lifetime. Fear of the personal, scientific, and social opprobrium that evolution would bring on his head had made him so obsessed with accumulating definitive evidence that he was bogged down in an elephantine manuscript called Natural Selection that actually never did get published. Ill and reclusive as he was, Darwin realized that he desperately needed a cohort of intellectual supporters whose expertise could help him refine his theory, whose social unorthodoxy could reinforce his own, and who were ultimately willing to fight the massed array of opponents whom he knew his heretical theory would generate. And of course, all the four voyagers were drawn together to each other by their common memories of hardship and pleasure in the Southern Oceans. It was a rough, secular Freemasonry that bound them together as shipmates, well salted in early life, as Huxley put it. Out of their Southern adventures came their lack of social pretension, their interlocking scientific interests, and their common participation in Darwin's evolution war. It was the training ground for the fleet captains of Darwin's Armada. Well, that was a brief précis of my recent book, Darwin's Armada, that Margaret so kindly flourished for you to go out, dash out and buy. It's been published by different presses in Australia, Britain and the United States as a trade book, sometimes known also as a crossover book. That is to say, it's a history aimed at a general educated readership rather than a specialised academic one. It's also the basis for an international TV series called Darwin's Brave New World, which is due to be screened in Australia in three parts in October on ABC television. Well, a number of my academic friends are puzzled as to why I've chosen to go down this trade book and TV route. They argue that the pressures of commercialization force such works into fatal compromises. They are dumbed down, they become mere stories, they say, devoid of analysis. They abandon originality in preference for known and predicted plots. They favor sensation and romance over complexity and if you like, sensibility. No academic, for example, is more criticised or even derided by his peers than the popular British-American historian and TV pundit Simon Sharma. What's more, he's become a billionaire on his private work, which is a fate clearly worse than death, and to be avoided by all academics. These criticisms are not without foundation. My last trade history book, called in Australia The Seven Ordeals of Count Cagliostro, ran into many of these problems that I've just described. Its eighth ordeal really became dealing with the editors, the PR people and marketing people in the world's largest publishing house in the United States. Although I'm proud that that book has gone into 14 languages now, I must admit that the publishing process was mostly miserable. My editor in New York couldn't get it into his head that the book wasn't a novel. In fact, he constantly described it in all of our correspondence as your novel. And he couldn't understand then why I wouldn't change the facts or direct quotations in order to improve the story. He just thought I was being stubborn. The marketers also changed the title to The Last Alchemist, a title so original that the last time I looked on Google, there were at least three other books by the same title. Perhaps the worst indignity that they tried to inflict on the book was a cover picture which was supposed to represent Count Cagliostro. It had an elderly magician with a wizened face and kind of curly beard like Merlin and a wizard's hat. I tried to point out that Cagliostro, who's almost certainly the greatest con man in history, actually looked and behaved more like Tony Soprano than Merlin. This is a man who managed to con Casanova twice, and Catherine the Great and Marie Antoinette, among another cast of people. I also have to say that it almost became a film with Miramax. And although I'd have loved the payment, the script that I saw that they were going to film was so excruciating that I would never have lived it down. I would have had to go and live in the Riviera. So why then did I risk trying to write another trade history in Darwin's Armada? Well, first and foremost, I did so because I believe that the historian's most precious and powerful tool is the ability to tell fresh stories about the past that speak to us in the present. In fact, I, above all, would want to be described as a storyteller. But unfortunately, narrative is sadly out of fashion in historical academia. We favour a kind of more sociological and arcane form of analysis, and often one that the general public finds opaque, using words, so it seems to me, a kind of new priestcraft. Yet I believe that stories are the most important way we connect with each other in this world. They connect and can connect across the boundaries of nation, class, gender. And I want to be a historian that reaches out beyond his own specialised caste. I truly believe that we should embrace and, if necessary, reform rather than abandon the forms like the trade book and the TV history. And I have to say that in writing Darwin's Armada, the reverse of my previous experience has been true. My Australian editor with Penguin demanded more rather than less science. He never asked me to dumb anything down. He simply asked me to clarify it, which is, of course, a salutary thing to have to do. Neither did he, during the bicentenary of Darwin, try to force me towards a more orthodox interpretation or more orthodox pieties. He was delighted that the book gave equal time to what, for the general public, are the unknowns of Hooker, Huxley, and Wallace. And he also was delighted that Australia, or Australasia, became as important a part of the evolution story as South America or the Galapagos. My title, Darwin's Armada, if not the subtitle, has also been retained by all the three different publishing houses. They've all delivered covers that I'm not ashamed of. although they did insist on the old Darwin, you know, bearded Darwin, instead of the young, vigorous Darwin of the Beagle days. But we'll leave it at that. And I have to say that the copy editing of Darwin's Armada was the most rigorous I've ever experienced, far more rigorous than any of the famous academic presses that I've worked with in the past. And making the TV series has also been a really positive experience. For a start, it was collaborative from beginning to end. We started to work on the TV series at the same time as I started to work on the book. So the book and the TV series went hand in hand. They informed each other throughout the whole process. We'd meet once a week in an Erskineville wine bar, the producer, sometimes with the scriptwriter and others, buy a bottle of red or two, and then spend hours arguing about the drafting, the testing of episodes, the different emphasis that was going to be put, and the trying to find a way of expressing in visual terms the kinds of things that one has been writing about in the Darwin story. It turned out to be, in all honesty, one of the most exhilarating intellectual experiences of my life. This is a lot to do with the producer himself, and I think is a remarkable man. I believe that the result is a genuinely fresh, original, and truthful, as far as we can go, work of history. It speaks to us in Australasia, even though it is going to be shown and is a consortium that is German and Canadian and the United States as well. It combines vivid episodes of docudrama with interviews and discussions by contemporary scientists and philosophers, people like Dawkins, of course, David Suzuki, Jared Diamond, the great Darwin biographers Janet Brown, James Moore, and many others. Above all, the film conveys, it seems to me, a holistic and human context for this major intellectual discovery. It shows how great science is never a truly solitary process. It's never made in abstraction from society. It's never free from human pressures of ego, competition, envy, malice, of love, compassion, all those things. Genius does not float in from the heavens, it's shaped in the social world. And Darwinian evolution especially so. Moreover, the medium of the visual moving image also taught me something important about the evolution story that I'd not previously realised. In an age when scientists were expected to illustrate their works from the pre-television age, where illustrations were a crucial part of the argument, the reason there is no illustration in The Origin of Species, there's one diagram, there's no illustration, is that Darwin could not find any pictures in his own time that did not mislead. All the illustrations of his day were encoded with the idea of creation. They assumed that species were static, permanent, and divinely designed to fit particular niches. Birds, for example, were shown by Gould as kind of Victorian nuclear families, mother and father in their separate spheres, daddy being the breadwinner, mummy doing the nurturing. No breath of the struggle for survival, no breath of the struggle over sexual reproduction. How, moreover, was Darwin, let's think about this, how was he to depict visually something that was not an event but a process, something that was invisible in the present? It occurred only, as he said, in the mind's eye, not in the visible eye. It's a process that worked by minute variations over eons of time. How are we to illustrate something like that? And because of the film, I suppose because of this visual medium, I became aware how innovative Darwin, Huxley, Hooker and Wallace had been in trying to manipulate and adapt the visual traditions of their day. The use of cartoons, the use of melodrama, the use of non-elite forms of visual culture, something that Darwin excelled at and is little noticed. I think he would have loved to be able to have had moving images and CGI in order to support his arguments. When we think about some of the processes for which Darwin had to expend volumes in explaining, we were able to show visually in a matter of 4 or 5 seconds. Just to give you a few examples, Darwin argued from the 1840s onwards about the affinity between the human hand, a bat's wing, a whale's fin, and so on. Very complicated argument, which we, using CGI, can show in the film when he holds up his hand and it turns into a bat's wing. Darwin tried to show the affinities between animal emotions and human emotions. He studied his children, as you probably remember, to see how their emotions resembled those of the apes or the monkeys. In our case, with the modern movie, we can show him looking at these children and their faces morphing into those of an ape and bat. It's conveying a message visually that is very complicated to do by writing. This is, I would argue, only one of the insights that arose out of a process of trying to communicate a historical drama of ideas through the visual medium of TV or film rather than simply through a book. So in conclusion, I'd like to plead to my fellow academic historians that if we're not to become extinct like other species before us, we must learn to adapt to the needs and tastes of the present and the future. We must embrace and reshape the communicative moves of moods and processes of our time. We need to embrace and reshape the trade book, the TV doco, the video game, the blog, the e-history, even the dreaded Twitter. Otherwise, like the dinosaurs before us, we shall surely perish. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ian, very much for that very engaging and erudite summary. Now we have 15 minutes, which is your opportunity to ask Ian any questions that you may have for him, either about the paper or, I assume, about the book, if you've already...
Anything you like.
Now there's an invitation. We don't have a roving microphone in this room and we don't have microphones in the corners. So can I ask you perhaps to stand up and speak up with your questions? One in the front here.
In his court case, how close was he to being charged and convicted?
Of?
Because of his ideas. I mean, there's many of the scientists people were heavily opposed to what he said.
Sure. But Darwin himself wasn't taken to court.
Not himself?
No. I mean, he feared that he would be prosecuted for blasphemy. And one of the reasons he delayed publishing for so long, for 20 years, is that, of course, a lot of working class agitators from the Chartist period onwards were being prosecuted for blasphemy, for saying exactly the same kind of thing that he was saying. He was terrified that he'd be seen as somebody who was subverting the whole stable order of society. As you know, he was a reclusive and gentle man, and he found the prospect of publishing absolutely terrifying. I mean, it's one of the reasons that he was so ill, so chronically ill, throughout his life, because he just was appallingly frightened. But in the end, he did it. And I would argue, in part, because of the fact that he was supported by these young enfants terribles, people like Huxley, who were itching to get in there and have a Barney.
Ian, to what extent did Darwin's time in Australia, could you tell us a little bit about his time literally in Australia? Did that lead to any specific conclusions?
Thanks, great question. Look, the funny thing is that people have misunderstood the Australian episode because Darwin was immensely homesick by the time he got here. And he was down in the dumps and miserable. And he grumbled quite a deal about Australia. He didn't like convicts. He didn't like the drought. He said immediately, Australia is never going to be as great as America because there's not enough water. So he knew he knew what he was talking about. But in fact, there are two very significant moments in Australia, and also, of course, even more so in Cocos Keeling Islands, which is part of Australia now. But on the mainland of Australia, one is this moment when he sees a platypus that's just been shot. And he says, what's weird about this is this platypus, and this one complicated, extraordinary creature, looks exactly like, from a distance, it looks exactly like a water rat. And it seems to have a similar place in nature, sort of ecological function, as a water rat in England. Why on earth would there be such different creatures? And he's lying there also looking at an antlion's nest, and he notes the little sort of tunnel, and he notes the antlion is on the surface identical, does the same thing, it looks the same, except in Australia it's small, and in England it's different. And then he talks about parrots as compared with English birds. So what's happening is, and he then says, look, I mean, either this has been made according to creationist theories, this has been, you know, done by two different creators, you know, who've got, you know, woken up in the northern and the southern hemisphere, or it comes out of a single mind. And by that he meant a single process. I mean, after all, his parents were going to read this, so he's not overtly talking about materialism. It's the only moment that publicly he writes about the origin of species until he publishes in 1859. It's a very significant moment. The other significant moment is when he comes across a group of young Aborigines, and he says, well, first thing he says is these people are not as the colonists tell me. They're rather remarkable people. So a very positive evaluation of them. But he did then go on to say, I fear for their existence in the struggle against the species that has invaded this country, in effect, because that species, the white man, is destroying the habitat of the Aborigines. The guns, the dogs are killing the kangaroos, the sheep are getting rid of the traditional environment. And in effect, I mean, he's not saying that the Aborigines are doomed. It's not a racial argument. He's saying that, here he's saying that the population is threatened because its environment is being changed by an invasive species. Now, that's a kind of foreshadowing of the theory. Even more so in Cocos Keeling. That's another story. I don't know if you want to hear it. But in Cocos Keeling, essentially, he's interested in trying to find what creates a coral reef, the origins of coral reefs. He also does a kind of ecological survey of the whole island, and he ends up, as he's leaving, saying, look, here's the coral reef. It's been created by a tiny creature. That creature has brought about a new creation. As a result of what the creature has done, as the land subsides, the creature builds these great ramparts. And those ramparts stand against the enormous forces of the sea. But he said their population is, they're in a battle, a struggle for survival. He uses that exact, a struggle for existence with this population of corals against the sea, the sun, the fish. We have a kind of formal variation of the theory spelt out at Cocos Keeling, supposedly, 2 years before he read Malthus. So I think that's really very significant. And people have misinterpreted because he's grumpy about Australia. You know, neither here nor there.
Is the Huxley that you spoke of the author of Raging Bull?
No, that's his grandson. Young Aldous Huxley. There's a lovely letter from Aldous to his granddad, because he read Kingsley's The Water Babies, and in there, Kingsley's The Water Babies, he describes Professor Huxley creating these, you know, sort of Darwinian creatures, and he writes this little letter between them. I would also contend that Brave New World is modelled on a wonderful lecture that Grandfather Huxley, T.H., gave at Oxford in 1893, in which he says, what would happen if we stop evolution, in effect? If we build a wall around it, like a gardener builds a wall around nature and then changes what happens inside of it. And he does a sort of hypothetical Brave New World, and I think Aldous was influenced by that to produce the book.
Was there a question at the back? No. Ian, thinking about some of the arguments that you've been presenting and the way in which we sometimes think about the history of science as a series of almost amazing insights, to what extent do you think that evolutionary theory would have been written about had it not been for Darwin?
Well, it was. Wallace came up with the identical theory in 1858. Now, evolution was around. The difference is that nobody had produced or could have produced the mammoth amount of evidence. As Wallace himself said, if I'd have published, you know, imagine if Darwin hadn't been around. A, no one would have read it, because he was a working class boy educated in Mechanics Institute who no one took any notice of. And the second thing is, I'm unable to put any proof. I mean, the creationists would have blown me out of the water. The difference with Darwin was how incredible the amount of evidence he had amassed in all fields, of which the origin of species is only a tiny. I mean, it was meant to be an abstract of his ideas. Even though it's quite a solid book. So, I mean, you know, Darwin also then, of course, goes on to produce an enormous number of other books, including The Descent of Man and, you know, The Influence of Emotions. And, so, you know, no question that he was a genius, but also evolution by natural selection was in the air.
Yes, and oddly enough, I remember reading in a fairly extraordinary debate in Perth, in the Mechanics Institute, of all things, in the 1850s, before Origin of Species was published. And it was arguing in terms very similar to that. And if you think about Perth in the 1850s, it's hard to think of a more isolated little place on the globe. So I was fascinated to think that those ideas were percolating around. I think, was there a question on here?
Yeah, Ian, I'd like to discuss the second part of your presentation.
Sure.
One thing that strikes me is that we in the humanities have dropped the ball in presenting what we do to the outside world, and we've left it to social sciences at one end who do practical things, and the creative arts at the other who make new things. And it seems to me trying to come up with an argument for the reflective disciplines, history, English, and mind, etc., the problem we have is presenting it as innovation.
Yes.
Do you have any reflections from your experience, or how would you run that argument?
No, I think you're absolutely right. But I just don't know why we really make such a fetish of being opaque or being specialised in our language. And, I mean, you can see that in some ways it's been an an academic defence in the humanities against the fact that everyone can do it or everyone thinks they can do it. I mean, anybody can write about history, anyone can read a novel and do some criticism of it. Nevertheless, I think trained and specialist and sensitive people can often do it rather better. But somehow or other we've been intent on imitating a kind of scientistic or, you know, view of the world. And the net result is that, as you say, we've vacated the territory, which is our natural territory, communicating with people. And you'll see most of the trade books in history are written by journalists or amateurs, often very, very well, but you find very few academics. I mean, there are exceptions doing them. It's actually looked down on in the profession. And I mean, I can only do it because I'm kind of old and, can sort of more or less get away with it. But it's a genuine problem. I mean, I have to advise young scholars to be extremely careful about moving into the popular area, because they'll probably be bypassed for promotion.
Question just about you talked about the moving image as being more capable of conveying an idea quickly, and suggested that a hand turning into a bat's wing is evocative, but at the same time, if you watch Ghost Whisperer, a person's face can turn into a demon's face, and it has absolutely no follow on that there's any truth behind any moving image. They have been popular ever since early Magic Lantern presentations for presenting scientific ideas, but what would you say about their capacity to portray lies as much as truth, and in context of your pushing intellectual boundaries from academy to trade book and TV series, when these tools get into the wrong hands and convey untruths just as...
Absolutely, no question at all. I mean, in fact, you know, for many, many centuries, people have worried about the visual medium's capacity to lie. It creates illusions. No question about it. It has to be done in collaboration with the word, with ideas. All I'm saying is really it has a certain congenial characteristic to portray movement and process, which is what evolution is. The static nature of even photography was part of the problem that Darwin and co faced. So that I just think it's when done, when used well, it's remarkable. When used sloppily or in a deceitful fashion, it's as bad as any other medium, if not worse. Yeah.
We probably have time for just one more question.
You made some comments on the differences or the process of developing moving image from the research that you've done. Do you have any further comment on the differences in the process of writing in the academy and then writing the trade?
Yes, I mean, I think the central importance of telling stories, and telling stories in a way that is captivating without in any way dumbing down or distorting what you're doing, is a very great art. I mean, the novelists can teach us an enormous amount. They don't just, novels have been crafted in the most complex way in order to grip and engage us, in order to convey very, very complicated ideas in an accessible way. So I'm a great believer in the power of narrative, in the power of storytelling, and in using literature as a model for trying to present stories in a compelling way without, and that's the key, without distorting the primary sources. And I mean, I tried to say to my publisher, in the case of the Cagliostro book, look, this is a quotation. You know, this comes from somebody in the 18th century, a spy or an inquisitor, wrote down these words, and they allegedly came from the lips of Cagliostro. I can't change them. He wanted me to change the word ass into derriere because he thought it was extremely, you know, telling to, you know, going beyond what's necessary to put the word ass in it. Well, unfortunately, Kelly Ostro used the word ass and worse. So it's this kind of, you know, we are bound by the sources. We're absolutely bound by the evidence. But all of us shape the evidence in some form, some kind of plot. And so that's what I think occurs out of the academy, much more than in it, the emphasis on how you communicate.
Thank you, Ian. I think probably we're out of time. So it's been a fascinating discussion across a wide range. Darwin ideas, how we construct history, how we present history in public, and all of the challenges involved in that. And Ian has excelled, I think, in all of those fields. He's going on to have a conversation at 3 o'clock with a range of others in an interdisciplinary conversation, if that interests you. So you might like to follow the conversation in that way. But will you join me now by thanking Ian very much?
I'd just like to say thank you very much, and that we have a very famous man we're honoured to have in this particular academy at the moment, Frank Fenner. All of us owe him a great deal, and I'm honoured that you're here.
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Barsmith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.